Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 40 of the Commentary Track. I'm your host Frank Thompson, capital L, small a, capital F, small o, small n, small g, Thompson. I'm going to make this intro short today because the interview is pretty long, and by long I mean great. It was really, really fun. My guest today is James Curtis. You know, I had never met James Curtis until yesterday when I recorded this interview at his home, and that still surprises me because he and I came onto the scene at about the same time. He's certainly far outpaced me in levels of bookselling success, but we came about it around the same time. His book on James Whale was the first on in Tony Slide's filmmaker series for Scarecrow Press. It came out in 1982. My book on Wellman was number 4 in the series and came out just a few months later in early 83. And so I was always aware of Jim Curtis and liked his book. Then he wrote a terrific book on W.C. Fields and a book on Preston Sturges, a book of interviews with Mae Clark. He rewrote the James Whale book to make an even better book. And I read them all and enjoyed them all and have always admired him as a writer and as a film historian and as a biographer. How in the world it happens that we just never met each other, even though we live relatively close to each other, and it's just one of those weird things. I saw him at a screening of International House. He interviewed Rose Marie before the screening at UCLA a couple months ago. And I thought, well, I really need to have him on the show. As it turns out, my friend Jordan Young, who was last week's guest on the Commentary Track, knows Jim and has known him for years and years. So Jordan made the intro, and voila! I think that you will really enjoy this. He's a terrific speaker as well as writer, tells great stories, and has interesting experiences to relate. And I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with James Curtis. So give it a listen, and I'll see you on the other side. You and I started out our film book writing career at almost exactly the same time.
Yeah.
Tell me how you came to it, because it must have been a very different road than I took.
Well, what happened was there was an event that used to take place in Los Angeles every year called FilmX at the Century City theaters. And one year they did a tribute to James Whale, and in 75, as a matter of fact, and what was significant was that they ran things beyond just the horror movies that everybody had seen on television, Showboat and One More River and things like that. The Old Dark House, which no one had seen up to that point, in a very bad print provided by Raymond Rohauer, and so I got kind of interested. I went in and saw all those things. I was in college at the time and driving a laundry truck. And just for the sheer mystery of it and because I didn't know what I was doing, I started wondering what there was to him that was so mysterious, you know. So I did something that probably was irrational at the time, but I sent a letter to Max Lemley, who was in charge of the Lemley Theater chain at that time. And I asked if Carl Lemley Jr. was still with us, who produced all these films, and if so, could I speak to him? I don't know why in the world I thought that anyone would want to bother with me. You know, I had no credentials or plans or anything. And about 2 weeks passed, and a letter came one day, and it was signed Carl Lemley Jr. And he said, here's my phone number. And so I called him, and I asked if I could come up and visit him, and I wanted to record him, which he wouldn't let me do. I had this quarter-track stereo deck at that time, you know, that took reel-to-reel, mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, I'll go up there and I'll interview him, whatever that meant to me at that time, and he was very ill. He was, I think it was multiple sclerosis is what he was, afflicted with. But, he was very nice to me. And at one point, he had the phone dialed by his male nurse. And he said, if you want to know about James Whale, you should talk to David Lewis. who was his best friend. And so he got David Lewis on the phone, and I was handed the receiver.
Wow.
So I just kind of stumbled my way through an introduction, and David's words to me were, well, he brought the artist eye to the camera. That was what he said to me. And I said, may I talk to you sometime? He said, you can come down right now if you want. And so I left Junior's house, which was a modern subdivision sort of home, although I'm sure it was custom built, on Tower Grove, if I remember correctly. I don't think I would have had to have started the engine in my car. I could have just let out the brake and rolled down the hill across Sunset and to San Vicente. And David's apartment was in West Hollywood. And I was there, and I knocked on the door, and he opened the door. And on the wall was this gigantic painting of James Whale, which is there on the wall as you came in now. And
I was going to ask you about that.
So that started that particular avenue for me. David at some point took a shine to me for whatever reason, and he brought up the idea of my writing a book about Whale. And he said, people have come to me before, and I've always been suspicious of them in some way or the other. And he said, if you want to try it, I'll help you, and if I like what you've done, I'll give you the ending. And so that started me on my quest, and not knowing what I was doing again or how you do this sort of thing. I don't think there are any classes on how to do this sort of thing, as you well know, and so I just started writing letters and combing through the phone books at the public library, and slowly I started to find people and talk to them. And when I put the thing together, you know, I was working, and late at night I would go in, and I had this little portable typewriter. I typed with one finger at the time. And I put this thing together, and I left it on David's doorstep one day. And he called me a couple of days later. Now, this is a much cruder version than what was published, which God knows was crude. And he said, I'm astonished at what you've done. He said, I had tears in my eyes when I finished it. And he proceeded to get me an agent in New York and all of this. And people said very nice things about it, but it wasn't publishable, or it wasn't published at that point. No one wanted to undertake it. And then when Tony Sly was starting the Scarecrow series, he knew I had the manuscript, and he said, would you like to see it published as part of this series? And I said, sure. So that's what happened.
Mm. Now, what was it about Whale that first attracted you? You had seen, obviously, some of the things.
Yeah,
Frankenstein,
I'd seen
Invisible Man.
Invisible Man and Bride, of course. And what intrigued me was the stylistic continuity that you saw in films as diverse as Bride of Frankenstein and Showboat. You could tell that both of them were directed by the same man. And that's what interested me. I think throughout my life I've been attracted to strong stylists, you know, strong individualistic talents. And so he certainly qualified there. And there was an element of mystery about him. A lot was written about him, but not a lot was known about him. And so that's where the intrigue came. And also from the fact that I was in college and had absolutely no idea what I was going to do with myself once I got out. So, you know, I had the extra time. I thought, well, why not? I never tried writing anything in my life. And so it was all kind of a developmental experience as much as anything.
Now, in terms of studying the film, since I did the Wellman book at the same time you were doing this, I started having to watch film, mm-hmm. and videotape only kind of came in toward the end of the process for
yeah.
me. So I was having to go to the archives, having to rent films. Is that what you were doing?
Yeah, exactly. You know, or I was scaring up prints where I could find them, you know. And fortunately with him, there were only 21 films, you know, so I wasn't dealing with someone like Spencer Tracy who made 75. That was an advantage in a sense. In another sense, however, it wasn't easy because a lot of them were terrifically obscure. And so I knew film collectors, and so one film, David Shepard showed me his print of Remember Last Night. That's how I got to see it. I borrowed a print one night from someone who had rented a print of Frankenstein so I could make frame enlargements of the creation scene, things like that. Showboat I did at some point also. I did the Old Man River sequence. I still got that stuff. But, you know, I was just kind of capturing this stuff, and I didn't know what I was going to do with it, and I thought I should have it. And so that's how it happened. But, yeah, I rented a few in order to – I think I rented Man in the Iron Mask to see it, and on more than one occasion. And then UCLA Film Archive, I watched a couple of things on the flatbed reader, the Steenbeck. And so slowly you got a chance to see all this stuff, but you had to know people, and, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't as easy as it is now.
Well, these whippersnappers today don't know how hard it was.
I know. Well, it's just like, for instance, the films that were considered such forbidden fruit back when we were coming up, like, The Chaplains, you know, the Monsieur Vadeau, things like that, or the Mamouli and Jekyll and Hyde, things you could, then you walk into Barnes & Noble and buy them on DVD. I mean, yep. It's just astonishing, you know, it was such a thrill to be able to see even a bad print of The Great Dictator back at the time, or Scarface, you know, things you had heard about, but
sure.
just had never seen, and now there it is, it's all out there for you.
Well, how many co-workers of Whale did you finally track down?
Oh, gee, over the years, quite a few, as it turned out, starting with Mr. Lemley and proceeding to... Well, David was kind of an unofficial co-worker on a lot of them, you know, because he was always around, and... you know, Louis Hayward called me one day, and I didn't have a recorder on the phone, and I just furiously scribbling notes. He was ill. He died not long after that. But there were things he said to me on that phone call that ended up as dialogue in Gods and Monsters. I've saved my berries, Hayward, you know, that sort of thing that came from that phone call. So yeah, Gloria Stewart, whom later, that's a long story, but you were mentioning Titanic earlier. She told me that's how she got the job in Titanic, was through me in a really roundabout sort of way. So, a lot of people were still around at that time. Jane Wyatt, I can go on and on.
Oh, May Clark.
May wouldn't talk to me at first.
Hmm.
Why, I was never particularly sure, and by God, she did later, of course, but what had happened was I took David out to the motion picture country home one day because he wanted to visit Norma Shearer, who was out there. And so I took him out there twice to see her. And Norma Shearer, by this point, had suffered a series of strokes, as I understand it, and... She was in difficult shape mentally. Physically, she could still get around, and she was very strong. We were warned when we were in her presence, don't get too close, because she will grab onto your arm very tightly, and her grip was like a vice, uh-huh. and you didn't want that to happen. But anyway, I took David. He sat with her for a while. They were very, very close at one time when he worked for Irving Thalberg, especially, and then after Thalberg's death. And so afterwards, we were walking around the grounds there, and there was very low security in those days. I don't know how it is today. And we wandered into the office at one point, and David says, May Clark lives here, doesn't she? And I said, yeah. And he knew I couldn't get her to talk to me. And he said, let's go to the office. And so we went to the office, and he said to the woman behind the desk, is May Clark in? And she said, I don't know. I'll look. I'll see. And so she got in the intercom. They didn't have phones in those days, but they had intercoms in the individual room. So she got on the intercom and said, May, are you there? And the voice came back, yeah. Somebody to see you up here in the office. Didn't ask who. You know, never used a name. So we stand there for a couple of minutes, and here comes this woman through the door, and she's carrying a golf putter, which I found out she used to kind of work on her grip. She wasn't mm-hmm. a golfer, but she'd use it to point out things on the property. And David said to her, he was towering over her, David's a tall guy, and he said, you may not remember me, but my name is David Lewis. And she goes, David Lewis, and she threw her arms around him, and so that was the connection. She said, well, this very nice young man here is doing a book on Jimmy Whale, and I wish you'd talk to him. And she said, oh, sure.
Wow.
So that was it.
Well, she must have had great stories
about
Whale.
Yeah, she did. I grew very fond of May, and I ended up of course, doing that book with her, also for Tony. And it was a lot more work than I thought it was, but she was very proud of the fact that it was going to happen. And as I describe in the introduction to it, she had gotten her prognosis for the cancer while we were still recording it. And I said, when she told me about it and when I heard about it, I said, do you want to continue with this? And she said, yeah. So we did the final two sessions, I think, and she knew she was going to die very soon. And but we got it all. And for what it is, I think it's a nice book. I'm glad I finally finished it. It took a while to get it done, but I thought it was worthwhile.
Yeah, I corresponded with her quite a bit, but never met her in person.
So. She wrote very quirky letters. She was always great in how she expressed herself, and so I always enjoyed her, and we got along just great.
Yeah, of course, I talked a lot of Public Enemy with her, but
sure, of course,
which was a very mixed memory for her.
Yeah, her story about the grapefruit and all that was a highlight of the book. I really dug into that with her, and as I'm sure you did as well.
She must have had much more positive memories of Whale, though.
Yeah, she did. Well, she did three films with him, and the thing was, the revelation was seeing Waterloo Bridge.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and she is, I mean, she's not just good, she's great in that.
That's well, talk about films that you couldn't see forever.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh,
then
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Once you did, you just thought, wow.
Wow, yeah, that's right. And so I was delighted. I think that film, above all others, convinced me to agree to do that that book with her. But when I started seeing other things she did, she was an awfully good actress. She was very, very good. And so I had enormous respect for what she achieved. And I think if there's a pattern in what I've done, it's always been a body of work that attracts me. And May's body of work, especially pre-1937, was pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious as to, we'll back up a little bit, because how you said how you became attracted to Whale's body of work, but were you thinking about writing about film anyway, or was this completely out of the blue?
Just completely out of the blue. I read books on film, you know, and this was a...
And you were a movie buff, or...?
Yeah, well, that goes back to watching them on television at a time when you didn't have to, you know, these days, everything's so vertical. You know, if you want to seek out a specialty of some sort, like old movies or football or whatever, you go to that particular channel. And, you know, they got the wheat germ channel today. And back then, everything was all over the VHS channels. And so, and you got used to the car commercials and the guys that did the car commercials. And I can remember the jingles for some of them still. It's amazing what you retain. Yeah, I just consumed all that stuff, and part of the reason I did, when other kids were out playing ball and that sort of thing, I've been blind in one eye for my whole life, so my depth perception is lousy, and so whenever I tried to catch a ball or hit a ball, I could see where it looked to be for me, but that was never where it was.
Sure.
So I couldn't hit anything, I couldn't catch anything. And so I developed a real antipathy for team sports, because I was never a valued player in school. So I just stayed home and watched things on TV all the time. And I you know, during the late 50s, early 60s, you know, I can tell you what was on any channel at any given time at any day of the week. And so I was kind of an insomniac in those days, so I saw all the late things as well.
Yeah.
I was up till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, so I just consumed a lot of this stuff. And you know, in an unsophisticated sort of way, you know that some of it is better than other stuff, but you're not quite sure why. You know, and so you know the black and white Popeye cartoons are better than the color ones.
Sure.
You know, that sort of thing. But you're not sure why that's the case. And so as I got older, I started revisiting a lot of this stuff. And I think that's where the subjects that I've addressed have come from, was a reevaluation from a different perspective. And the body of work holds up, the style holds up, and so you want to know more about it. And also, is there a need? Does the world need another book on Orson Welles or Alfred Hitchcock? On the other hand, does the world need a book on James Whale?
Well,
there
I think
you are.
So, sure.
Yeah, so there's that difference as well.
I was, when I lived in Boston, I guess I was probably 22 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And we were invited to a party at some guy's house, and a friend of mine said, "Oh, you'll like this guy. He's a real movie buff like you." So we get over and I meet the guy, and he said, "Yes, I'm writing a book." And I said, "Oh yeah, about what?" And he said, "About Alfred Hitchcock."
Really?
And remember, I'm 22 years old. Mm-hmm. So this was well more than 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And I said to myself, another book on Alfred Hitchcock? Who in the world needs another book on Alfred Hitchcock? And since I was 22 years old, how many thousands of books on Alfred Hitchcock?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Have
back
come out?
Then, yeah. Well,
yeah.
He was still with us at that time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it just shows how much I've been able to see into the future.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Man.
Yeah.
Was the May Clark book the next thing you worked on? Did you go straight into that?
No, what I did was after I finished the James Whale book, I started fishing around. David encouraged me to try another one, you know, knowing that the more you do something, ideally you get better at it. And so that's when I got curious about Preston Sturges, because I had seen his films on television. KTLA Channel 5 originally was owned by Paramount, and so for a long time they had the Paramount pictures in their library, and so I had seen a lot of that stuff, Sullivan's Travels and the Palm Beach Story, that sort of thing. And there were always stories about Sturges and everything I read, but there was no source for Sturges, you know, and I asked David about him, and he said, well, I had the office next to him at Paramount for a little while, and so I love Preston, he was a great guy, and so I mentioned it to my agent again, and I certainly didn't have the wherewithal or the cachet to get a contract or something like that. So, again, you know, I'm still going to college, and so I just embarked on it. And I sent a letter, again, being a complete idiot about it, I started looking through the phone book, and Rudy Valley was listed in the phone book.
Wow.
So I called him one afternoon. It's a good thing I didn't call in the morning. He didn't take calls in the morning. But I called him one afternoon, and he agreed to come that I could come up and interview him. And if I remember correctly, I went up to visit him on July 4th, 1976, the Bicentennial. He was, I think, 75 at the time, and he was playing tennis on his tennis court. And he sat down, put my little cassette battery-operated tape recorder on his leg, and just started talking. I think there were very few questions I asked. I had some questions, but it was a great interview, and that got me started on that. So then I was able, through UCLA, to get Sandy Sturges' address, who was the widow. And I wrote her a letter saying, is this something that you could approve of? And I just told her I had done this other thing, but, you know, I didn't have much of a resume to speak of. And so one night she called, and she, you know, the letter was just in front of her. She said, I think it's a great idea. And so I embarked on that. And, again, it was an embarrassment of riches at that time in terms of the people you could talk to, you know, Claudette Colbert, Barbara Stanwyck. Spent an afternoon with Joel McRae. I mean, William Wyler, who was in the phone book also, Billy Wilder, et cetera, et cetera. So it was just an astonishing array of people that you could see at that time. These days we'd be happy to get to their grandchildren, you know?
Sure.
And then the archival resource, which was Sturges' own papers, which were quite extensive. They were in catalog, but they cataloged them as a result of my interest in them. They've been used quite a bit since then, I've been told, but this was the first. It was a lot more ambitious a project, let's say, than James Whale, and I rewrote the book in total 3 times to get it into publishable shape, you know, and I still cringe when I look at it to this day, but it doesn't embarrass me like that first James Whale book does, you know, so I haven't undertaken to rewrite that one, but...
You shouldn't be embarrassed at all at the Preston Sturges book. It's terrific. I enjoy it a lot.
Well, thank you. I guess it's not the job I would do today with it, but the advantage, as with James Whale, was I got to a lot of people that weren't there when other people got interested in doing the subject. And so, I pursued Bill Demarest, who finally agreed to see me, and that was a really good interview, but, there was a long time when he wouldn't talk to me because, I heard that line that we all dread hearing, which is, I'm writing my own book.
Oh.
Yeah, don't you? Wince of pain.
Listen to my podcast with Jordan Young, and you'll hear us
tell stories about that. Yeah, we've all heard that line. So, but anyway, I sent him a desperation letter just as I was finishing the third draft of it. And so his wife, Lucille, called me. She said, Mr. Demarest, we'll see you. And so I drove out to Palm Springs one day and spent the afternoon with him. And he was just terrific. I love Bill Demarest. A great guy. And
well, he worked with Preston Sturges quite a bit.
He was part of the stock company. Yeah. In fact, he was kind of the head of the stock company. Yeah. But Sturges had a stock company of maybe 15, 16 of these wonderful minor character actors. And some of them not so minor, you know, like Porter Hall and the like. But Robert Warwick, you can go on and on with the people. And Rudy Valley did 4 films with him. DeBill, I think, did 8. But he was just terrific. And the third Mrs. Sturges was still with us, and oh God, there were just all kinds of people. His assistant director George Templeton, his secretary, all kinds of people were available, and so it was a great chance to really see him from a lot of different sides and perspectives, and that was the great thing when I redid the James Whale book many years later, was I had all these early interviews, which I could go back in mine and to a really great extent more fully understand what these people were telling me than I did at the time.
I'm curious about Rudy Valley, because I'm always curious as to how self-aware some people are.
Mm-hmm.
And the work that he did with Sturges seems to me so superior to anything else he ever did.
Yeah.
That I wonder if he was aware of that or if he thought that the same way. I mean, separate from his musical career, which is a different thing.
Well, he was a very earthy character when you're talking to him in person. I think he was. He was a guy that he had a singular view of the world. Let me put it that way. He was very nice to me. You know, he was famous for being cheap and difficult in some ways. But I said when I first talked to him and asked to see him, that I'd like to talk with you about your film career. And he said, I really didn't have a film career. But when you think about it, he did a lot of stuff.
Sure.
Up to and including How to Succeed in Business, you know, which was a late in life success for him. But I thought he was terrific on camera, and it was Sturges who saw those qualities and really brought them out. He had done films before, The Vagabond Lover and all that stuff, but Palm Beach Story is the first time someone had taken those intrinsic qualities and amplified them and fine-tuned them so that they come across so beautifully. And he delivered a line very well. And he was just terrific as Hackensacker in that film, and so he was perfect for what Sturges needed. He's wonderful in Unfaithful Yours too, which I think is Sturges' masterpiece. So he was aware that he was well suited to that without really considering himself an actor. And I can't think of anybody else who would have handled those parts nearly as well as Rudy Valley.
I've gone on record as saying that I think line for line, Palm Beach Story is probably the funniest script ever written.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It is just a brilliant piece of work.
It's tough choosing between the really top Sturges films, though, you know, and you weigh Sullivan's Travels against Hail the Conquering Hero, you know, or Miracle Morgan's Creek and Christmas in July, which is a wonderful, tight little film, and it's tough to embrace one and forget about the other. It's kind of like how I balance The Big Sleep and The Maltese Falcon, which is the one I've seen most recently is the one I think is a little
exactly.
bit better, you know. Then you see the other one again and think, well, you know, maybe that's superior. So it's great, though, because I think the distinction between a good film and a great film is this, that a good film gets a little less good every time you see it. The familiarity doesn't serve it well. A great film gets better.
Yeah.
You know, that's the difference.
Yeah. Palm Beach Story is definitely that way with me, that every time I see it, there's more in it.
Yeah.
And I think that almost goes with not every Sturges film, but most of them.
Yeah.
Miracle of Morgan's Creek, I think, is brilliant, just across the board. And Lady Eve, come on.
They're so dense that you just can't pick it all up in one viewing. You know, you go back and you hear lines you didn't appreciate the first time through, or you see little nuances. The standard line about Sturgis when I was first proposing to do this was he was a great writer and not so great director.
Yeah.
I disagree with
nonsense,
that. I think he was a terrific director, and he was absolutely the best possible director for the material that he himself wrote, and I think that was proven when you put one of Sturgis's films that he wrote and directed up against, say, a Mitchell Eisen film that he just wrote. There's a big difference there.
Sure there is, yeah. And there's something that's always struck me about Sturgis, and maybe you can comment on this, although it's a very weird thing to notice, is that he uses the most cliched kind of sentimental music and uses it completely sincerely for certain scenes. And I've always been struck by that, that he'll use basically Hearts and Flowers or those kinds of things, but will use them with no irony whatsoever. Yeah. And I've always, that's got to be a Sturgis thing. It's got to come from him because it happens in so many films.
Oh, no. There was a definite romantic angle to Sturgis and his personality and his creative sensibility. And I think the mistake that people make with him is they think, okay, well, there's a cynic at work there. And that's the starting point, the home base that they use to analyze his work and him. And that's a mistake. There's an aspect to that. And I think that comes through in my book that he was really a guy that bought into this. And I think that's why his films work so well, because when there is sentiment in his films, it's genuine and it's heartfelt. If it's phony, it wouldn't come across the same way.
Yeah.
And so I agree completely.
Yeah, I don't think I would admire his films so much if he were cynical.
No.
Because I don't admire cynicism.
So no. Well, there's a lot of irony in his films.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, and that's definitely, and satire, but I think at the base of it is, Sturgis is a very genuine guy who had a tremendous upbringing and a very Catholic interest, and he had a way of formulating them and putting them on the screen in a way that really that audiences of that period really responded to. There was a time at which, you know, he and Capra and the like, their style of filmmaking had gone out of fashion, but I think ultimately the quality of their work prevailed, and it's timeless today.
The weird thing about Sturgis is that his candle flared so brightly and so hot.
Mm-hmm.
And then went right out.
Yeah.
He
was tremendously self-destructive. And I think, looking back on this, and I'm not sure I got this into the book so much, but he was terribly fatalistic, and he felt very strongly that he would not live past the age of his mother, and he did not. And, he once said that his philosophy of life was living in contemplation of death. So there was a dark
side. Well, that's funny.
Yeah, there was a dark side to him that, I think he was out to shoot the works, and that's why he tanked the way he did. And it just happened at a time when, the film industry was contracting, that William Wyler said something interesting, which I think is very true, which was, the problem was everybody has flop pictures. He said, that's not the problem. The problem with Preston is that you had to hire the whole package. You couldn't just hire him to come in and direct somebody else's script. That was not possible. When you hired Preston Sturgis, you got Preston Sturgis the writer, you got Preston Sturgis the director, you got Preston Sturgis the producer. You got the profligate Preston Sturgis who couldn't stay on budget, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you got all that stuff. And it was that entire package that people were kind of wary of in later years. Dorie Sherry, when he was running MGM, commissioned Sturgis on a step deal to do a wonderful script called Nothing Doing. Well, it's called, it has different titles, but Nothing Doing is probably the best of them. And it was going to be a film that Sturgis was writing for Clark Gable. And it was a terrific idea. It's a terrific script. And the last portion of that, once they got the script where they wanted it, which they did, and Gable had agreed to do it, that they had to decide whether or not to use Sturgis as the director on it. And Sherry was wary of that. And ultimately, the film did not get made. It's the one great Preston Sturgis script that could be made today. Mm. And perhaps someday somebody will.
That would be great.
Yeah.
If you could find somebody who could actually bring it to life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was talk of it at one point, I know. Michael Douglas at one point was talking about doing it. But of course, he made the decision or the mistake, I think, of giving it to Marshall Brickman to rewrite, which is not the point here. You can edit the thing, but you don't want to rewrite Preston Sturges.
No.
And it would have to be done in period. It would take place in the 40s, but I think it'd be a charming film to do. It's as good as anything he ever wrote.
No.
Yeah.
If anybody were actually listening to this podcast, I would say, somebody make this happen.
There you go.
You know, the one weird thing, one convergence between something we were talking about earlier, my friendship with Charlie Barton, his wife Julie, Julie Gibson, is the woman who's singing Home to the Arms of Mother.
Oh, that's right! In
Hail the Conquering Hero. Yeah.
I have the sheet music for that, with maybe her pictures on it.
Yep.
Julie Gibson, wow. I never knew that.
Yeah, she's, and as many times as I've watched that, I can never put that woman together with the Julie that I know.
Is she still with us?
She is still with us.
Wow.
She's going to be 100 in September.
Wow! Good for her.
And, yeah, there you go.
Great.
So, wheels within wheels. Everything converges.
Yeah.
You did the May Clark thing came next, and then when did it occur to you to rewrite the James Whale book?
Well, I went off and got jobs doing what I was trained in college to do. I was a business and technical major, and so I went off and I fell into marketing. And did a lot of that, and was making. It was a good career for me. It was really nice, and it took up a lot of time. And so it was a long period of time where I didn't address myself to these things really. And then it occurred to me early in the relationship with my my second wife, my current wife, I should say, also, where we were talking about James Whale and the book, and she had read it, and I just kind of made a face at it. That thing really, you know, I had such good material to work with, and I just didn't know what I was doing then, and so. It occurred to me what I would do is I would take the material I had, the interviews I had done in the mid-70s and the like, and I would simply rewrite the thing so that it looked like an adult wrote it and put it back out again. And then my thinking evolved, and I thought, well, maybe I'll do a few more interviews so long as I'm going to bother. And then, well, maybe I should go to England and actually look at some of these places. And, well, and so it just snowballed. And I ended up redoing the whole thing, of course, and rendering the first one completely obsolete, which was my intention. And doing new interviews and re-listening all the old ones and taking, in some cases, different passages or rewriting them to better reflect what was actually said and the meaning behind it all. And so I had this brand new and I thought much, much, much superior job for the world of publishing, and I couldn't get arrested with it. Nobody wanted to publish it. I had the title for it long before it went out, called New World of Gods and Monsters. And so finally we set it up with Faber and Faber US, and this was a screwy deal. And Faber turned out to be one of the worst excuses for a publisher. My first experience of British publishing, of which I've had several since. And Private Eye calls them Failure and Failure, which I think is really... but they were the only ones that had the slightest interest in it. It was going to be a publication in both Britain and the United States. They thought there was a British market for it, which, of course, obviously there was. And so we let it out again that way, and it did very well. It surprised the hell out of them. It was their top-selling book of the year.
Wow.
Not that that was much of an achievement with Faber and Faber US, but then... FS&G bought them and wanted to reprint the thing because it was selling so well. And by that point, I think the movie was in the mix or it was just coming out. And they refused to do it. And so finally, Farrar Straus, much to their credit, they took a copy of the book and burned their own plates and got the book back in print that way. And we've gone on through several editions of it. The current one is out through University of Minnesota Press, and it still sells. I keep waiting for it to go out of print so I can put an edition out of it because it's not available that way. But it still sells. They just reprinted it not too long ago. So that's my validation for doing that. But it was kind of a screwy way to go about it.
Did the film Gods and Monsters have any impact on it, do you think?
Probably some. You see, my attitude toward the film was that it was fiction. It was based upon...
Sure.
I'll tell you the distinction on that, is that straight readers and straight viewers think that the film was based on my book. Gay readers and gay viewers know that Chris Bram wrote it, and it was called Father of Frankenstein. I think that was the working title of the movie. It, curiously enough, did not become Gods and Monsters until they knew that my title was Gods and Monsters. And so my attitude was, and the book was out about 6 months before the film came out, and my attitude was, you guys work your side of the street, I'll work my side of the street, okay? And they, unfortunately, never fully respected my wishes in those that respect, because I did not care to feed off the film. I wanted it to be something that was in the marketplace on its own.
Sure.
And frankly, I didn't care for the film much. So, and they kept trying to pull me into it in some way. And I got to the point where I refused to do interviews where people would ask about the film or they wanted to talk to me because of the film. In part because I had met Chris Bram and I thought, you know, he should be getting the attention, not me. But for God's sake, eventually they put my name on the poster in England. Which just astonished me.
Wow.
It was a jaw-dropping thing. And again, I did not want that kind of association, but I thought that was unethical, but there you have it.
Wow. Father of Frankenstein is a book I've never read. It's a novel, though, isn't it?
Yeah. It's based, it's derived from my first Scarecrow book, is what it was, which he says in the back of Father of Frankenstein, the novel. And, so it's a very odd interlacing of two different pieces of work, but the book and the film would not have existed without my work on James Whale as put forth in the first Scarecrow book.
Mm. Well, at least they could have cut you a check, it seems to me.
It was a real low-buck operation, believe me. I doubt if anybody made any money off of that other than Bill Condon.
I only barely remember the film. I remember seeing it, remember thinking, eh.
Yeah. I'll tell you the things, my response to, and I only saw it once. I saw it at Film Market here in Los Angeles. A German film buyer whom I had met in Spain came over. He acquired films for German television. He said, do you want to see this thing? And I said, sure, I'll go with you. They had no distributor at that point. And that's the only time I've seen it. You know, however clever Condon is at wringing the last possible bit of production value out of a minuscule budget, which he seems to be quite good at, I didn't think he was good with his actors in particular. I thought Lynn Redgrave was way over the top as the housekeeper. I described her to somebody as Mrs. Olsen on acid. And Ian McKellen was not James Whale. I mean, he worked in the context of the film, I guess. But I was talking about this one day with Julie May, who is the niece of David Lewis. And she was around James Whale a great deal when she was a child and later young woman. And we were talking about the film one day, and she said the same thing without me bringing it up, that Ian McKellen was not James Whale, and Chad wasn't Jimmy Whale. And so we were talking about who would have been better at it, and I suggested David Bowie, and she said he would have been a lot closer, and I think he would have been too.
I would cast? Kevin Brownlow.
That's what Julie said, strangely enough. I tell you that's true. Yeah. She said Kevin Brownlow is like him in some ways too.
Looks like him.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. Anyway, for what it's worth. And then there was a rival group of producers who were going to do my book. And Ron Shedlow and his team, which was going to be And they were talking about Christopher. They were talking about Kenneth Branagh, who I was wary of at first, but then I thought, well, you know, maybe so. So Kevin Brownlow actually wrote the screenplay for it. And then they couldn't get the money together.
Well, there you go.
Yeah,
look at
that. So Kevin's screenplay is of my book. I never read it. I saw the first few pages of it because we were corresponding one time. And I said, how did that work? We exchanged faxes back in the day. And I said, here's how I would open the film. Okay. You'd open with this body floating in the swimming pool, and it'd be up from the bottom of the pool, and you'd see all the flashing flashes of the news press and the like. And then you'd hear on voiceover, it'd be James Whale's voice, and he'd be saying something like, okay, I know you've seen this before somewhere, meaning the opening of Sunset Boulevard.
Sure.
And so Brownlow faxed me back the first five pages of his screenplay, and that's how he opened it.
Wow.
So there you have it.
Mm.
But anyway, that was 98, 97, something like that, when that was all going on.
Now, coming back to it that many years after you wrote your first book,
mm-hmm.
how many people were there now who still had Whale connections for you?
Surprisingly, I came up with a few. The one time I met William K. Everson was in his office at NYU, and he said, there's a guy named John Latham who used to come to some of the showings, and he knew James Whale. And you might look in the phone book and see if there's a John Latham in there. And if so, so I did, and got him on the phone, and by God, he was there right from the beginning. He remembered being on the set of Frankenstein. And knew David, knew the whole group, and so we got together. I didn't have a tape recorder with me. I was in New York for other reasons, and I remember running down to Broadway to one of those Middle Eastern cheap electronics places, you know, and buying a tape recorder just to record John Latham.
Yeah.
And we had lunch. And he was just wonderful. He had a terrific interview. So I was delighted to get that. And so there were others along the way, of course, as well. But more of Gloria Stewart. Who else was around at that point? Harry Morgan, whom I didn't talk to the first time, who was in Hello Out There. So there were a few. I went and found some others, you know, and I was very happy to get them.
And when you went to England, it was mostly for family stuff, or did you?
Family stuff. I met his nephew.
And he made a few films there, too.
Who was a Methodist minister, and he was very nice. I talked to Dora Zinkhuizen's children, her daughter and her son, who were very nice. I talked to people who knew him in England, and did a lot of work at the Theater Museum Reading Room. A lot about his stage career that I was able to really flesh out over there, and that was nice, and to be able to see the theaters that he worked in. And went out to the Black Country. There's a Black Country Museum, which really gives you a strong idea of what his childhood would have been like. So all of that was immensely valuable, and that really helped give me a coloration, a texture for that second book that I would have had no clue as to how to do the first time around.
Yeah, that's... I've never revisited something along those lines, but it would be interesting to do that.
It's an odd experience, believe me. But I'm glad I did it. Again, I had the advantage of really singular material to work with, and so it was not appropriate, I thought, to sit on it and not do something better with it. And
sure.
So that was my reasoning.
You must have had more luck. Well, you had plenty of luck with Whale co-workers, but when you started working on the Walter Houston book, there must have been a lot of people who knew him.
Well, I'll tell you what happened with that one. When I was doing the second book, you ask about people who I talked to that I did not speak to the first time. One of them was a screenwriter named John Weld. And I had, through my agent, David Hull, who at one time had worked at Universal for Hitchcock, incidentally, he was fascinated by James Whale going way back, and he had pulled some things out of the files back then, like, for instance, the script inventory on Invisible Man, and he had copies of this stuff, so he gave them to me. And everybody at Universal did a draft of Invisible Man. Preston Sturgis did one. There are all kinds of people that worked on Invisible Man. Governor Morris, all kinds of people. And but just before R.C. Sheriff did his draft, which was the one that actually ended up getting shot, there's a man named John Weld. And I wondered, well, gee, wonder what's going on there. Who is John Weld? Well, almost concurrently with that, I saw that there was a John Weld who was a member of the Authors Guild, which I was as well, who lived in Laguna Beach. And I wondered, is this the same guy? So I looked in the phone book. He was listed, so I called him. And I said, I'm explaining what I was doing. I said, are you the man who worked on The Invisible Man? He said, yes, I am. And I said, may I come down and see you? And he said, certainly, I'll tell you about it. So I drove down to Laguna had a very pleasant conversation with him, and he remembered what he was doing. Probably part of what became the R.C. Sheriff screenplay was John Weld's work. It seems reasonable to me to suspect that, although there are aspects of The Invisible Man also that are obviously Sheriff. They had an apartment overlooking, he and his wife Katie had an apartment overlooking the beach in Laguna, beautiful place, and he had a lot of paintings on the wall. And I was noticing one which was a painting of a watermelon that had been split open, and it was signed J.H. And I said, that's a very interesting painting. It kind of caught my eye for whatever reason, the use of color. And he said, John Huston painted that. And I said, are you friendly with John Huston? And he said, he's like a second brother to me. I said, really? And he said, I was his father's secretary for a while in the 30s. And I said, really? And I said, I made some comment to the effect that it's always been surprise to me that there's never been a book about Walter Huston, because I think, hands down, he was one of the top three or four actors in films. I mean, he was just terrific. And he and Claude Rains, a few others that are right there at the top. And he said, well, we tried writing a book, and nobody was interested in it. And I said, when was that? And he said, 1937. And I said, how far did you get with it? And he said, well, and he disappeared into his office and came back out, and this aging manuscript was in his hand. It was typewritten. It was Walter Huston's story, written as a biography, but with tremendous blocks of quotes directly from Walter Huston. And then the manuscript had been annotated in Walter Huston's own hand. And I thought, my goodness. And so I read a couple of pages of it, and I said, John, have you ever thought of finishing this? And because it went up to 1937 and stopped. And he said, find me a publisher, and I'll finish it. So I got Tony Slide on the phone, and I thought, here's a good opportunity. And so Tony agreed to do it. He and Bob came down, and we went down and met with him. And John was in his 90s at that point. He almost lived to be 100. And he started getting a little cloudy, and I had to work in behind him. The last portion of the book I pretty much put together. He had letters from Walter Huston, so I used those. I took quotes out of them, and I did the later stuff, Devil and Daniel Webster and Treasure Sierra Madre. That's all my stuff. But up to 37, 38 is John's stuff, and all the quotes are great unpublished things that Walter had to say. So because of that, we do have a pretty good record of one of the finest of our great actors of that period, I think.
I agree. So you didn't interview that many people who...
No, I didn't interview anybody for that. No. I just worked in behind John on to get the thing finished. But a lot of the heavy lifting had been done decades before. But it's an amazing thing that book survived and that it was still available for that purpose.
Where's that manuscript now?
Probably with his papers. His papers are at, I think, UCLA. And so I think that stuff is there. It should be anyway.
I was just talking with somebody about Huston the other day. He seems to me now to be on the verge of being forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
But what a remarkable range he had. And I just think, show a double bill of Dodsworth and Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Yeah.
And look at what this...
or All That Money Can Buy, Yankee Doodle Dandy,
you know?
And you see how it all fits together. One of the great things about that scene in Sierra Madre where Howard is taunting them, you're dumber than the dumber sure. jackass because there's gold under your feet and you don't even realize it. And he just instinctively breaks into a jig. There's a song and dance man for you.
Yeah.
You know, but it works beautifully in that moment. You know, he's in the moment. He's in that. And that really gets you wondering and thinking about the magic and the depth of somebody that does that sort of thing for a living. And they do it so well, it becomes art. So there's no better. I'm proud of the fact that although I don't have an extraordinary sensitivity to the actor's lot, not being one myself, that we have biographies of two of our greatest actors through my efforts.
Well, I want to. Obviously, we're getting toward the end of what I should legally be able to hold you here for, but
that's okay. Go
ahead. I want to ask you my first question about the Spencer Tracy book.
Mm-hmm.
Is how in the hell did you get any publisher to let you write a 1,000-page biography of anybody, much less Spencer Tracy?
Well, I didn't expect it to be that long. And just to point it out, it's not 1,000 pages that you're supposed to read. It's
a lot of notes.
Back
yes.
matter notes yeah. and all that stuff, author's note, et cetera, et cetera. So it's actually 878 pages of text. Mm. Still a long book, but it's not 1,000.
A mere evening's read.
A light evening's read. The more I got into Tracy, the idea for a first draft, and I was talking about this with Scott Berg one time, and we worked the same way in the sense that everything that could conceivably go into the final book goes into the first draft, you know, and then you can pare it away, but
sure.
but you're kind of on a journey of discovery at that point, so it goes down, and then you can go back and, you know, slice it out at some point, and so Tracy suggested so many different themes, you know, and threads that you had to deal with: alcoholism, Catholicism, the relationship of Katharine Hepburn, the relationship with his wife, you know, the ability of doing what he did as an actor, the weird business of being a movie star at that time, which is much different than it is today. Et cetera, et cetera. I mean, alcoholism is in there. There's all kinds of things that you've got to work your way through there. So I dealt with all of them. And I dealt with all of them as fully as I felt I could. And the idea was, and I'd just pare it back, and if parts weren't working, we'd cut those entirely. And so my editor at Knopf, Vicki Wilson, who had great interest in seeing this done, read it and of course urged me to cut some things, and I'd say to her, okay, I'm going to cut this thing about Hepburn because it doesn't relate directly to Tracy, it's a kind of an offshoot. She said, you can't cut that. Well, this part here, I think I can lose this, the reader will never, don't touch that one. So ultimately I think I took out, oh, I don't know, a couple of hundred pages out of the thing, but it was a big manuscript, as you well can imagine.
Sure.
And there was a point at which we kind of jointly decided that we had kind of a unique opportunity here to really look deeply into the eyes of somebody who is still to this day regarded as one of our greatest actors in this country. And we had a chance to do something that was extraordinary, let's say. And so she agreed, and there was a point at which I went through the editing process, and the book was copy edited twice. Not once, but twice. And you know, I kept expecting the boom to be lowered at some point, that Sonny Maida would say, no, we're not going to put out something that long. Are you out of your minds? You know, and I'd expect they'd come back and say, okay, chop out X many number of words out of it, which I was prepared to do. I knew the things I could lose and no one would miss. or not so many photographs. You know, I gave Vicky, I think, 150 with the idea that we'd get them down to about 75 or so, you know, maximum. She threw out five of them. Wow. You know, I wanted to throw out some things that she told me to leave in. So we decided at some point, okay, let's let it rip. We're going to do it. And that's what happened. I did not think that we would take the volume of abuse that we did over the length from reviewers. I think it's partially a comment on the state of book reviewing in this country, which is pretty terrible, I think. And these are people who resented having to read something that long when they weren't particularly really interested in Spencer Tracy or the subject matter. And so it's a cheap, easy thing to do. Just keep harping on the length of the book and not talk about the guts of it.
Sure.
You know, there's so much they missed that's in there because I carefully built it in there. That was a problem. And so it gave them something to really, you know, they just rolled it up and beat me over the head with it. But in a way, complaining about the length bypasses the question of the quality.
Well, sure, it does.
You know, it's like you're on a second track. You know, it's parallel existence, and so ultimately, I decided the hell with them. You know, if you can't respond to it, then that's your failing and not mine. And that carried me through the day, I think. I'm proud of it. I think it's the best thing I've ever done.
Well, when I asked you about the length, I was certainly not criticizing.
No.
I'm simply
that.
Saying
I
want to do that,
I
want to put out books like that.
No. I didn't set out to do it, but I set out to accomplish a job that when you were finished with it, you felt you had walked a mile in the guy's moccasins and you understood him.
Sure.
And part of the problem with him is there's been so much misinformation put out there about him. People have such idiotic notions about him, and just so much. And a lot of it is the work of people who were proposing to write books about Hepburn. He became collateral damage, in effect. But there's just so much utter, what the French call merde, you know, that I had to deal with a lot of things that perhaps in another instance or circumstance I would not have had to deal with simply because that stuff was out there. And if I didn't deal with it, then somebody else would say, see, he's avoiding talking about this. So that was part of what was driving the length, unfortunately. I regret that I had to do that, but I did have to do that.
Did you gain any insights into his work as an actor during the course of writing the book?
Yes, very much so. As close as I could come to it, and part of the challenge of writing about the creative process, there's a point at which you can talk about the prep, you can talk about the circumstances, there's a point at which the thing happens, and you're left to marvel at it. That's all you can do. You can't explain it beyond a point. And so within the context of what Tracy did and what you can see, I understood the depth of the emotional damage he did to himself over a long period working the way that he did. It was the only way he knew to work. It was very much an untrained sort of thing, although he did go to the American Academy, of course. He was educated in technique to some degree, but a lot of it just came straight from within him. And the alcoholism, the adultery, all the stuff that got him through his life and resulted in a deep sense of self-loathing that I think animated and in some ways informed his great talent, was all necessary. I mean, you take away any part of it. It's like in the later years when he was in such delicate health and there was this kind of support group that surrounded him, that encircled him. His brother Carol, Louise, his wife, Hepburn, Stanley Kramer, you know, you could make a list of about 8 or 10 of them, and they were the ones that enabled Spencer Tracy to be Spencer Tracy. And if you took away any one of them, the whole balance would collapse. And I gained even new respect for Stanley Kramer, who is much maligned in literature and in criticism especially. And I don't think I over-romanticize it, but I think in his time, Kramer was a terrifically admirable fellow in what he did and what he tried to do, and often perhaps fell short in some ways, but that doesn't diminish what he attempted. And when he did ring the bell, I thought he did it wonderfully. But I'm one of those people also who love Mad Mad World, you know. The world, the population is divided in
yes.
groups of people who hate that film. nobody is wishy-washy about that film, but I'm on the lover's side, and I just think it's a terrific piece of work.
I will pass over that. Well, Tracy, I think he's one of those guys who, I don't say he denigrated his own work, but he kind of dismissed the effort that he brought to it.
Yeah.
He's always one of those guys who just said, you know, learn your lines and don't bump into the furniture and, you know.
That was opposed to some degree.
Yeah.
Because I discovered.
It had to be.
Yeah, you know, because he would be up all night working on a part or on lines, and then he would.
And he was too good.
Yeah, he was too good, and then he would come in the next day and say to the script, where are we shooting today?
Yeah.
You know, let me see the page for a moment, you know. And people would, you know, I just think he loved that. But I think that goes back to his sensibility as a child when he was a boy magician, which he never talked about in later years. But his cousin remembered him doing magic tricks, and he would give magic shows in the basement of their house for the neighborhood kids. And that's all part of it. You know, you've got a certain persona that you put forth, and you have certain tricks, and you don't yeah. want people to see the secrets. You don't want to see the wheels turning.
Well, there was also a whole generation of those guys, it seems to me. John Ford was one of them. Mm-hmm. Clark Gable, I think, was one. Guys who seemed a little bit embarrassed by being
Wellman
in show business.
Not.
I think Wellman
yeah.
was.
Yeah, you know, I think that was all part of it because there was some sort of sense among these guys that what they were doing was, now these are guys that are born, you know, at the turn of the century or in the
yeah.
19th century, you know, and there's something slightly effeminate about what they did, you know, and,
So they had to dismiss it. They had to say,
yeah,
this, oh, yeah.
yeah,
this, I just do
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, you know, it was something trivial. And,
yeah.
and of course it wasn't. And the ones that did it well could not seriously regard it as trivial and do that kind
no.
of work to that level of quality. And so that was a pose. You know, I think it was.
But, yeah, I've always thought Tracy was one of the greats. And one of the, I think one of the first truly natural actors who just does not seem to have any artifice
yeah,
between him and the character.
But that too was a trick.
Well, sure.
You know,
of course it is.
You know, magicians call it misdirection.
It takes a great deal of skill to
yeah.
appear that offhand.
Yeah, yeah. And he had that on stage. You know, his wife described it. She called it that natural thing. You know, but she was an actress herself, and she understood what went on behind it. And so that was interesting to see the kinds of things that he would do, you know, to affect the impression of naturalness when it wasn't natural at all. You know, you've got a crew of 40 surrounding all these lights and a camera and the boom overhead, but you're just sitting there saying something that creates the illusion of being off
yeah.
the cuff, you know, and,
in fact, it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is incredibly difficult, and it requires a remarkable amount of concentration, and that's where it ate away at Tracy, I think, especially with material that was inferior to what he could do when he had the best material to work with. You know, because he was forced to make a lot of junk in order to earn a living and keep the income coming, and. When he had really good material like Judgment at Nuremberg, then he could really knock it out of the park, but that wasn't always the case.
And even the things that kind of went a little left to field, like Captain's Courageous,
yeah,
he still brings total conviction to the thing.
Right. You know, technically that's not the best performance. You can pick it apart, but the heart of it, the soul of it is there. And that's
yeah.
what I think viewers respond to. That, and as he pointed out at the time, he's absolutely correct, Freddie Bartholomew, part of his impact as Manuel in that film is Freddie Bartholomew's reaction to him.
Sure.
You know, and Bartholomew, at important points in the story, is an audience surrogate. you know, like during the death scene, you know.
Yeah.
So that has tremendous impact too. Freddie Bartholomew is a really good actor, and I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to meet him or talk to him.
Mm. Before we wrap this up, which you're saying we should have done hours ago.
No, that's okay.
I really want to ask you about the book you're working on now, William Cameron Menzies. That
yeah.
sounds right up my alley as well. As every one of your books.
W.C. Fields isn't up your alley?
Oh, absolutely. Man, I revere Fields. How in the world did I skip the Fields book?
Menzies has always fascinated me, and I started on, you know, talk about someone who had a fingerprint. You know, you can always tell a shot that he had composed
sure.
in a film. And I remember taking note of, when I was a kid, I'm sure you did too, we saw Invaders from Mars on television, you know, and that was something. And then how your mind kind of retained the name of the director because it filled the entire screen, you know, of those three names. And so I've always been curious as to why there wasn't a book on Menzies. I kept expecting one to come about. And finally, in the late 90s, I decided, I went into the Academy one day and pulled his obits to see who survived him, and saw that he had a couple of daughters. And so I started looking for the daughters, and I got the phone number for the eldest of the two daughters, born 1921, and her daughter answered the phone, Pam, and she had just died. And Pam was cleaning out the house, and so we talked, and she gave me the number for her aunt, the younger of the two daughters, who was Susie Antles. And so we spoke, and she was very articulate and funny, and great memory. And so I started doing interviews on Menzies in the late 90s, and unfortunately there were only a few people that I could really talk to. Sam Wood was long gone. His daughter was dead. Susie had a lot of material, a lot of his artwork. It was in her garage. And so I undertook to start to organize it a bit and go through all these boxes and find old letters and memos and stills in some cases, and just start to pull it together. And I talked with my editor, Knopf, about doing the book, and she wanted me to do Spencer Tracy. And so they agreed to do Menzies, which they expect to sell three copies of, if I would do Tracy first. And so I got all the perishable stuff amassed on Menzies, and drafted pretty much, I think, two-thirds of a first draft of it. And then I had to put it aside for 6 years to do Spencer Tracy. And I came back to it a couple of years ago and finished it off. By that time, Susie had died. Dick Silbert had died, who I had a remarkable conversation with one day on the phone about Menzies. But I had gotten enough people, I think I had the story as well as anybody could. And it's the first book I've attempted that really is driven by the graphics as much as it is by the text. And so this is going to be an interesting experience. But I think it works well. Ideally, for it to work well, the text and the captions and the images themselves have to work in harmony
sure.
with one another. And making sure you don't repeat information, the captions that are in the text and that sort of thing. So it's not 1,000 pages, but it's. I think we've got some really, really good stuff, illustratively speaking. And so I think it'll fill a niche, and it'll also get people to thinking, reevaluating Menzies' contributions, because. For instance, a film like Foreign Correspondent, where you have two really great visual stylists working together,
sure.
and so you see the melding of their sensibilities in that one, and you can see more clearly what Menzies brought to the production. Gone with the Wind, you know,
oh, yeah.
things like that. So next year is the 75th anniversary of Gone with the Wind, so we'll kind of coordinate with that, but it'll be out a year from September 2014.
I'm trying to think how many films Menzies directed.
Oh, gee, offhand, probably 8, I guess.
Yeah, I figured it's just a handful.
Yeah.
Maybe
10.
I suppose you went to the 3D festivals they've had here. but it's the first time I ever saw The Maze.
Yeah, I saw it at the Egyptian when they ran it. Again, yeah. I can't see 3D, so but I wanted to sit there and at least experience what it was like to wear the glasses. And the thing that was useful to me in watching it was that I never realized, I should have, but I didn't realize that they have to have the break in the middle of the film since they're using both.
Sure.
They can't do changeovers. So that reminded me of that, which I did not know before. But, it's kind of a... That film is kind of an object of fun within the family, you know.
Well, it's... I would say 90% a pretty good film. And it's so strikingly visual. But man, the ending of that is the worst ending of any film I've ever seen.
Yeah, the man and his frog, yes.
Yeah.
I remember when we were sitting there at the Egyptian, and I had Menzies' daughter sitting next to me.
Who?
And...
Well, she had to know going in, right?
Yeah, she knew. She knew. And, yeah. And, but this is what he had to do to earn a living, you know, and at that stage in his life. And, she, after the film ended, and she just looked at me and she said, poor daddy. The thing to bear in mind, about Menzies' later things that he directed, was that, you know, he had to earn a living.
Sure.
But Invaders from Mars and The Whip Hand, although it's in a mutilated form, thanks to Howard Hughes, are films made with top talent. They're working on a budget, but, I mean, you have Nicholas Musaraka as the cinematographer on Whip Hand, John Seitz, for God's sake,
sure.
on Invaders from Mars, Boris Levin as the art director. I mean, they're all really top people. The Maze was made by an Allied artist, which was Monogram, and all the people who worked on The Maze were Monogram veterans. And so that Maze was Poverty Row from start to finish, and he really didn't have the kind of classy support that he had in those other films. So that's the basic difference, I think. And the fact that also, one thing that Menzies, if any director did not need 3D, in order to put depth across in his films, it was Menzies. You know, he knew how to get depth into a film,
sure.
and he could do so without the gimmick. So I can see the rationale in engaging him to do the film, but it was basically a mismatch, you know, and it's not a film that I particularly like or have much regard for.
It's only notable to me because I can't think of another film that goes so far south.
Mm-hmm.
So quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Well, it's rather a dull script, too.
Yeah.
You know, it's so-so. But
no, it's never going to be a masterpiece, no matter what you did with it.
But, you know, Invaders shows you how good a low-budget film can be, and I'm convinced that the original version of The Whip Hand was the same way. That they were two really spectacular pieces of work on a very, very much a shoestring budget.
Now, I told you we were wrapping up.
Mm.
But then I forgot to mention W.C. Fieldstein. And I could never forgive myself if I didn't talk to you a little bit about Fields.
Sure.
How did that book come about?
I met socially one of his grandsons, Everett. And it turned out that Everett had his grandfather's papers in his house. And so we had known each other socially for a while through Tony Slide. So... I had finished with the James Whale thing, and I thought, maybe I'll do this again. And I said to Everett one day, would you consider allowing a book to be written about your grandfather that was a serious biography? Not the Robert Louis Taylor thing, not what his brother Ronnie did, which was collect the papers, which was a great service, a terrific book, but someone to approach him as a serious biographical subject. And... He said, yeah, I think so. Now, this is a family that doesn't get along very well, I should point out. So he wasn't speaking to certain siblings, et cetera. So this was not the easiest thing in the world to do. But I started talking with people, and I was amazed the number of interviews I could get on Fields at that point. The book came out in 2003. I guess I started it in 97, 98, something like that. There were still four or five Ziegfeld Follies girls that worked with him. You know, the eldest I spoke with was 102 years old.
Wow.
But also, Bob Whitey, who did the film with Joe Adamson, W.C. Fields Straight Up,
mm-hmm.
let me refer to his outtakes. The great thing about these documentaries that they do is, as you discovered with Wellman, is that they'll shoot an hour of somebody and use 30 seconds of
sure.
it. So what's going on with the other 59 minutes of material? Well, it's just sitting there, you know. So what did they say, you know? So I went back and I looked at all of that stuff. I found his secretary's daughter, who was very nice, Ginger, and she had a trunk full of things, including his notes for The Wizard of Oz. You know, but
wow.
he was going to play the
sure.
wizard, and so he had gags he had written out. The early pages of his autobiography, which he was dictating near his death in 1946. Talked to Les Paul, who recorded his last performance. I mean, just all kinds of things came out of the woodwork. And my goal there was, though, the standard riff on Fields was he was the same as the guy you saw on screen. You know, which is put forth by Robert Louis Taylor in his book, which is a funny book. And I think he necessarily did that because he couldn't get the cooperation of the family, and it was done not long after his death, and it was done with Gene Fowler's participation, etc.
Sure.
So there were a lot of reasons to put it that way, but the legend had overtaken him to such a point that you just lost sight of the human being. What was this guy like underneath all that? And so that's what drove me. I wanted to see him as an artist, and how he developed over a long period of time that famous persona, you know, and it happened over a long period of time. It's like Jack Benny. Jack
sure.
Benny didn't spring fully formed in front of the audience, you know. It took years to acquire some of those characteristics,
yeah.
being 39 years old and driving a Maxwell and having Rochester and things like that, and being cheap. And Fields was the same way. The act developed over time and ultimately was crystallized in on radio in the late 30s when he went on with Edgar Bergen. And so that's the story I wanted to tell. And people would say to me, people are not trying to be nasty or anything, say, do you really think another book on W.C. Fields is needed? What's there left to say, you know? And two people who said that to me apologized to me afterwards. It wasn't necessary, but I could see where they were coming from. But they said, boy, do I owe you an apology on that one. And that's really nice.
As well they should. It's a superb book. It really is great.
Well, the idea was I wasn't serving up what people expected, you know, and because there was a spiritual side to him, and I got in the end, and, you know, there's just lots of things that if you go in with the idea that one of the things I wanted to do with him also is I went in with the idea that I was not going to use anything I couldn't source. So some of the famous stories about him, like the looking for loophole story, ultimately, those were apocryphal.
Yeah.
I could not find where they existed in his lifetime.
Too bad.
Yeah, it is too bad. That's one of
I'll still tell it.
Yeah, that's one of John's favorite stories. He was pained to hear that it didn't
yeah.
happen. But there was so much there that was real that you don't miss the few things that were not. But it's as close as I think it was possible to come to in terms of what you get as a result. And I hit it magically at a time when there was an opening to do that, where the people were available, where you could get to all the stuff, and that little window closed. Today you could not do that book again.
Mm.
It would have been good, you know, to do it 5 or 10 years earlier. Would have had more people to talk to, but I was lucky to start it when I did, and I was lucky to have the cooperation that I had.
Fields is one of those guys that as I came to movies seriously in my late teens,
yeah.
when I started, and I lived in a little South Carolina town where you couldn't see W.C. Fields.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this image of him that he was this surly, you know, guy who just was mean to kids mm. and kicked dogs and all this stuff. But he's not like that in the films mm. at all. He's mostly put upon
yeah.
as opposed to bullying
yeah.
others.
Yeah.
He's almost always bullied by others
mm.
and mostly just wants to be left alone
yeah. Yeah.
to have his drinks and have a cigar. And
Mr. Muckle, you know.
Yes.
He gets bullied by Mr. Muckle.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
And But I tell you, those, like Sturges, there's this quick burst of incredible stuff that burns very brightly, and in terms of film, I mean, certainly he had a huge career.
Yeah, but his heyday was really, you know, a period. He really came forth to the American public in 1933.
Yeah.
With the International House, and by 1941 it was over. You know,
yeah.
So it's about, you know, 7 years thereabouts, 7-8 years, and that's it. And but, you know, and he weathered some tremendous illness during that period too. He was off screen for about 1.5 years, but the impression he made and the way that he came back around after his death, you know, when the films were reissued, and there he was all over again on television. That's where I first discovered him. You know, and my father would laugh himself sick watching him, you know, and so that's where the connection came.
When I was in college in the early 70s, there was a poster of him on every dorm wall.
Yeah, Cheating at Cards.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We had those posters, you know, both of us. And, yeah, he was just an object of fascination, you know. Mm. And I kind of, in some respects, started work on him. In 1969, I sought out Eddie Sutherland, who directed six of his films, just to talk to him and ask him about him, and I was able to use some things he told me then in the book I wrote many years later.
Amazing.
Yeah.
We have a couple of friends who have an outdoor movie night during the summer,
mm-hmm.
and they invite some of their film buff friends like
mm-hmm.
me,
yeah.
but they also invite normals. And they, last summer, I forget what the feature was, but the short they showed beforehand was the Fatal Glass of Beer.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were six of us on the back row in the yard, my wife and a couple of other friends who are movie people, and then maybe 20 regulars up front. And we were screaming with laughter on the back row and not a titter from anywhere else. And I thought, well, this is foreboding. because that, to me, and it is an arcane kind of, it's a humor that's doubling back on itself in a way, but it's
well, you know, the
it's
thing,
a hilarious movie.
The
to
thing
me.
About that is, it, you know, it's people sometimes don't understand the process of biography, and in the book. It's my job to say, here's how it was at the time, you know, here's what the reaction was like then. I try to, the author's opinion is inherent in what is used in the book, how it's expressed, what you choose to emphasize. All of that is there. Fatal Glass of Beer, I can appreciate for what it is. I know where it came from, you know, it came from a stage sketch. Max Sennett hated it, you know, and a lot of exhibitors hated it. They just didn't get it, you know. It feels like it. He liked the boorishness of it all, but Sennett, there was just such a split of opinion, you know, and most people just loathed it.
Yeah.
And so I've got to report it that way. And the reviewer in People magazine, when the book came out, took me to task for not liking the Fatal Glass of Beer. Well, I don't say I don't like the Fatal Glass of Beer. What I say is that it's an acquired taste, and there are a lot of people who didn't like it when it was made and when it was first exhibited. So that of course, gets spun into that I hate the Fatal Glass of Beer, but I don't. I like all four of those shorts very much indeed, and I think sure. they're kind of a microcosm of where he's been and what he's going to in the way in which they come upon us in 1932-1933, you see some of his recent stage routines, and you can get a sense also where he's going with some of his later family-oriented features, like yeah. As a Gift.
He's such a subtle performer, and so many of the funniest things in his films are these tiny little asides or these mm-hmm. little gestures
mm-hmm.
that he makes, and he's... And you never forget that he's a juggler because he's so dexterous. And
that's the sort of thing you could never plan. If you put together a recipe for someone like W.C. Fields, you wouldn't say, oh, and make him a juggler.
Yeah.
you know, it just happened. And the fact that he evolved that way is just one of life's mysteries, you know, how that worked out. But he was just a wonderful amalgam of unusual traits that came together in a way that allowed him to make an impression. That he's another one that you see things in him, when you, on repeat viewings, you know, little asides and things. And there's this wonderful, sequence that he filmed for Tales of Manhattan. That was legendary for years because it was taken out of the film. As it turned out, Fox had all the outtakes. They had with the slates on them and everything. And you can see, if you're watching these outtakes, you know, well, he uses his street voice at one point when he's talking to the director, Mal St. Clair. And they start to roll film, and he's confirming with the director, you know, I'm supposed to do this and this. And it's not the voice you're used to, you know.
Yeah.
And then comes the slate, and then there's W.C. Fields.
Wow.
You know, and it's a remarkable little piece of film because it gives you a sense of what he was like off camera. And Ginger, for instance, was around the house a lot in her later, in his later years when she was a teenager. And I said, what was he like at home? And he said, he spoke very softly. You know, very, very soft-spoken man. Did he ever use his stage voice? And she said, I heard him use it once. And she remembered, I think it's in the book, where she would drive him around. They would go on for spins. He lived up in Los Feliz, and so they'd go down on Hollywood Boulevard. She remembered pulling up to a traffic stop one day, and he was sitting on the passenger side with the window rolled down, and it was a bus stop there, and people were sitting there and standing there waiting for the bus, and they looked up, and they saw him, and they could recognize who it was. And she said, and he said, yes, it's W.C. Fields, drive on, you know, and the thing, and off they went. And she said, that's the only time she ever heard him use it in real life. His performance voice, I guess. I
well, sure.
Say.
And he was performing, so
yeah,
there
he was
you go.
Performing. Yeah, there you go. There you go. But it's fascinating to me to delineate and show where this stuff was developed. And, you know, it's all part of the creative process, again, illuminating that part of it, understanding it better, understanding what animated someone like that.
Yeah, and in many ways, he's the opposite creature from Spencer Tracy, that he works to develop a stylized persona. He's he's not... He has no interest in appearing natural or offhand. He's
but the believability is still
yeah.
there, which is very important because he took personality traits and things that are common to people and that they can see themselves in which they can see themselves. And I think that's when a comic especially really connects, is when someone can look at someone like you said. I think the opening line of my book is comedy, Bill Fields would say, is truth. And that's the case, you know. He was true to the personality traits and the foibles of the everyday man and the frustrations, and that came through. And that's what people respond. That's why he lasts the way he does. That's why we can watch certain comedians like Laurel and Hardy and Fields and still enjoy them, and others like Wheeler and Woolsey or Clark and McCullough. And you know, you're kind of left scratching your head, you know, there's a universality to what they do, you know, and that's it's important to see that, I think.
Sure it is, yeah. And it's what makes them enduringly great.
Right,
and,
right.
And thanks for your book. That's just it's a wonderful book, and I'm chagrined that I forgot about it. But that's what happens when you don't prepare these things, you know.
You can cut it in post.
I never do. I always lie about that, but I never fix anything. Well, Jeb, thank you so much. This has been so much fun for me.
Thanks, Frank. Delighted to do it. Delighted to do it. Thanks for coming.
Well, I enjoyed that talk with Jim Curtis, and I sure hope that you did. And I hope that you will seek out most, if not all, of his books, because that is a library of biography that is well worth owning if you have any interest in film and the people who made films. And I'm really looking forward to his William Cameron Menzies book. And as we talked about, the Spencer Tracy book is mammoth, but worth it. It's really great, and I highly, highly, highly recommend it. And he's not paying me anything for this. I held the handout for maybe a little bribe yesterday, and I got nothing. Gave me some ice water, which was very nice, but I'm speaking from the heart. These books are terrific. Jim is a terrific writer, and I am so grateful to him for giving me all that time at his house. And I'm grateful to my wife for being my announcer, Claire McCullough Thompson. I am also grateful to James Hutchins, who devised and designed my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. I hope you'll go to the Commentary Track website and look at the books and video pages and order with great abandon using the Amazon links so that I will get a little bit of a kickback, because let me tell you, this is not a money-making proposition, and any little bit that you can do helps. And by ordering through Amazon, it doesn't cost you an extra penny at all if you use the link through my site, but I get a little bit of a kickback, and that helps. So if you want to buy some of Jim's books, then Jim would make a sale, Amazon would make a sale, the publishers would make sales, I would get a kickback. That is win-win-win-win-win with all the appropriate slashes between the wins. Thanks also, of course, to Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my beautiful theme music, Fore and Aft. Rob, as I've said before, also contributed the greater part of the music to my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest. We are having the first screening of it on June 23rd, which I'm really looking forward to. And last week, remember, I said that I couldn't believe that the process of getting the DVDs made was nearly over. Well, it's not nearly over. It's still ongoing. I'm cautiously optimistic that that will still be done pretty soon. I cannot explain how many roadblocks have come up in this project and how many technical problems we've had and what a nightmare it has been in so many ways. But as I keep saying optimistically every week, nearly over, it's nearly over, and when it is, all we'll have is this bouncing baby documentary that I'm so proud of and that I love so much. So I will continue to give you updates, although I know that for the last few weeks the updates have been still pretty much in progress. And soon there will be a happy day with trumpets blown when I will tell you that it's done and that the DVDs are in the mail, and that those of you who haven't already arranged to get them will start ordering them by the gross. By the dozens. Whatever. Order them in whatever quantity you like. I'm not here to judge. Just buy many of them. That's all I'm asking. So, that wraps up another commentary track. We will see you again next week with another great interview, I hope. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.